Hi guys, today we have a second part of our episode with our guest Rupang Yokoyama, the founder of the new youth-led nonprofit Climate Ingenuity, who was recently accepted to Aspen Institute's Future Leaders Climate Summit in May. He is also leading multiple policy-focused initiatives through his nonprofit, which is pretty relevant to this episode's topic, and today we're going to be discussing the need to expand solutions-based climate education.
Yeah, I like the idea of education and schooling not being so deeply, like they can be mutually exclusive. Actually, there's an organization, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called Earth Echo, but it's an international like student and teacher-based organization, and it gives like teaching curriculums to teachers, and it offers like resources and webinars and stuff, which is interesting. But also like the idea of having climate education integrated within core curriculum classes is very interesting, because I know especially like in a lot of the history classes I've taken before, where you've learned about the Industrial Revolution and the global and the different global wars and revolutions, you talk a lot about trade and how it's based off of the environment, because the environment is so deeply connected with everything that we as humanity have done over the course of our existence, right? So just integrating it in ways that would make it more accessible to learn about it, even if to move towards a more climate-based education. And you also talked a lot about the youth being interactive. So what do younger generations offer to the fight against climate change? How can our youth be and how can our youth be used as a weapon against this impending crisis?
Yeah, this is a topic I'm very passionate and excited about, and just something that is also goes hand in hand with it's a topic of the planned youth climate bill that goes hand in hand with the education component of it, which is but in terms of youth advantages, in terms of what we offer to the fight against climate change, like you said, there's a handful here, but all of them are pretty significant. One is that, unlike a lot of the older adults in power, I feel pretty confident saying I don't need to go and find a bunch of survey data to prove this. We don't have any ties to the fossil fuel industry. You know what I'm saying? And we're very eager to disrupt the status quo, and we less want to compromise for political reasons. It's our future after all, right? And we're much more likely to look out for the interests of everyone on Earth, collective interests rather than just regional self-interests. An example of that is that the Youth for Climate Manifesto, which was, you know, finalized before COP, covered loss and damage pretty well and said, hey, we want action on this subject on loss and damage for countries who have dealt with the brunt of climate disasters. But as you might have heard, at the real COP, loss and damage fell short in terms of not enough climate finance was dedicated to the subject. And lastly, we also have the power to form creative solutions. And climate science, the charity that I mentioned earlier, they hosted last year and are hosting again this year something called the Climate Science Olympiad, where thousands of young people from a global audience compete against each other to try to perform the best solutions to written prompts on real life climate issues. I participated in this mostly last year and got honorable mention. But the interesting part of that is, out of 12,000 plus participants last year, the winners of the Olympiad turned out to be two 14-year-olds who won for designing a global carbon tax proposal. And so it really goes to show that our generation is very committed to, when we have the chance to, committed to coming up with creative out-of-the-box solutions, effective solutions to these issues. And also on a personal level, like my ideas, initial ideas for the EV policy last spring eventually turned into this project where we submitted we ran at Save Over Hell America to the Youth Climate Action Challenge. And me and the people I was working with, former colleagues on that, we made sure to make use of the best policy principles, electrification, whole government approach, flexible regulations, without having to go into the weeds on what that means here. But, and we submitted that proposal to the Youth Climate Action Challenge alongside 100 plus other proposals too. But furthermore, in terms of how we can, maximize our impact towards addressing the problem of climate change, look, I think it would be great to see youth climate councils / advisory boards implemented a lot more in the coming years on climate. Because the thing is, everyone keeps saying that, young people need to be part of the policymaking spaces. And youth councils have been implemented successfully elsewhere, like outside the US. Like the Canadian government has, for many years now, from my understanding, has had a prime minister's youth council. And it recently created a youth council specifically for climate and environmental issues, starting last year. The UN Secretary General has I think it's called Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change, basically a youth climate council, but for the UN Secretary General. But in the US, I found that youth are concerningly absent from much all levels of policy making and decision making on climate. There is a quote that I oversaw from someone, a young person who attended COP last year, and this really resonated with me, and I really want to emphasize this here. Regarding COP, the leaders in those rooms, she said, the leaders in those rooms have no greater right to be there than we do as young people. And so we as youth, I believe really must pursue those spaces and make it clear that it's really important to us to have access and to have our voices heard in that sense, because the older ones in power aren't going to set them up for us on their own, at least in the US, it doesn't look like, as proven by how even right now, these days, they struggle to keep climate at the top of the political agenda to begin with. Fortunately, there has been good progress in recent years on this issue of youth involvement in policymaking, but not at scale. So what I mean by that is Youth for Climate brought in to Italy last year 400 youth delegates to two countries from across the world. Comms of U16, COI16, which took place basically right before COP in the same city as COP in Glasgow, did something similar in terms of, I think it was 300 youth from all similar amount of countries. And the youth, and like I mentioned earlier, the youth UN advisory group. The thing is, those are all good initiatives, but youth involvement in policymaking spaces absolutely can't and shouldn't be limited to two people per country. And what I didn't mention earlier from a numbers standpoint is that the fact that 12,000 plus young people apply globally for in-person spots to attend the Youth for Climate and the COP16 conferences, in which the ones who did get picked to go were able to submit policy documents and recommendations to, in COI's case, people who are going to COP, and Youth for Climate's case, people who are going to pre-COP. The fact that so many people apply to those initiatives really shows that multiple things. One, we as young people really actively want to be part of the solution. Two, we know that it's one of the most direct ways to make an impact. And third, much like a lot of other climate matters, youth involvement in policymaking spaces is long overdue. And a quick other idea in relation to that is, you've probably heard about how a lot of fossil fuel delegates were able to attend COP more than outnumbering a lot of country delegations themselves. I think in addition to banning fossil fuel delegates in future COPs for obvious reason, on the flip side, requiring sending a minimum number or percentage of youth delegates to them would be very helpful as well. Something that I personally, for Mark COP26 back in November 2020, wrote and fought for that specific policy clause that included, that was pertaining to youth involvement in these spaces and had a specific clause in there. And I think the other note, the final note I have on this subject is that I really think there should be just as much emphasis placed on directly helping current government policymakers instead of just criticizing them by default. And I say that because, look, solving climate change will require collaboration between generations. There's no denying that, no question about that. And so my hope is that, okay, so I missed this earlier, but for context, for the composite resource stockpile, I'm planning to add a bunch of features to it, and you know, further increase its practical value and shareability. And the plan before rolling out to the public is to roll it out to current government policymakers, to my network, to really see how it performs, and get feedback and get testimonials, and really have an impact, positive impact on their side right away. I'm really hoping that such an initiative that I'm leading and going to be continue to lead in the coming months with the stockpile with all the policymakers will be the first of many such youth-led initiatives to directly help policymakers fight climate change. Because this is, I think, it's another disconnect that is worth mentioning here, because like I said before, policymakers hear a lot of criticism by default from, I feel like, a lot of people from our generation for not doing enough. But on the flip side, very little is being done to actually support them directly. Say, hey, you guys are the ones who are the 20% of people who are in position to make 80% of the difference through policy on these issues. We're here to support you, and please do a good job of counting on you. So
if relating to, you know, government's solutions, climate education, if climate education was implemented earlier with past generations, do you think there would have been a greater impact on how we currently as a society are dealing with climate change and how our current governments are dealing with this global crisis?
Really good question. I think there likely would have been more margin for error to some extent today than what we actually have. You know what I mean? In terms of, in order to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we perhaps would only need to reduce emissions by 2% per year globally instead of 8% or 10% per year. And I think there would have been also more potential for more climate policy breakthroughs early on before the issue got so out of hand like it is now. I think that being said, though, there still would have needed to be an emphasis on attacking the problem early instead of what we're doing right now from a societal standpoint, which is addressing the problem reactively from behind. I think the influence of the fossil fuel industry would have still been problematic in terms of, you know, talking about like misinformation and money in politics, etc. And the effectiveness of international negotiations like COP would still have inherent flaws unless directly removed, say with like carbon tariffs, which would serve as a universal global compliance mechanism that the Paris Agreement lacked and still lacks. The interesting part is that I've actually looked into a lot of current, at least US government policymakers' background, and found one big theme that's kind of related to what I've talked about before, which is that none of them majored in climate in undergrad, and only a few of them, went on to study a master's in environmental management, which is not exactly the same thing as climate policy. And why is that? Because in line with what I mentioned, talked about earlier with the state of college and the lack of climate education in college these days, climate wasn't and still isn't offered anywhere near well enough at the undergrad level. One of the big reasons that I felt like I needed to compile 200 composite resources on a Google Doc for the SOC problems, because it really felt like, to me and others, one had to go to grad school these days to learn, to get a decent understanding about what is arguably the most important issue in the world. And that's not right, and that needs to change, right? So it implies that the policymakers today got most of their climate knowledge through their career experiences. And if those experiences are outdated, then from like 15 or 20 years ago, then I'm not really surprised, to be honest, at how what they're doing now as policymakers aligned with the latest intel on effective solution to policy. Remember, like, if you remember the 86% stat about how 86% of the books and publications are from the past 5 years, if they didn't catch wind of that, then I'm not surprised that how flexible regulations and electronic everything are not actively being pushed for by them, because those likely weren't even on the table when they 15 to 20 years ago, when they were getting a good chunk of their experience on career-wise on climate, which is another reason why I feel like the stockpile rollout moving forward and other such similar initiatives on education matter so much, because it's, you know, similar to how what I said earlier with how education and school are not the same thing, people can and must still learn more about climate solutions and policy after out of school and into their careers. So that's another thing to personally looking forward to that should make a difference, and is something honestly that I personally could not have conceived that I'd be doing even a couple of years ago, that I'd even have 200 solutions, or not solutions, climate policy educational resources about solutions to share at scale. So
yeah, that's really so actually following how much education is implemented in universities, there's this thing I read a little while ago. I heard about these ASHE STAR reports, A-A-S-H-E, STAR reports. So it's kind of like, it measures four educational like benchmarks of sustainability initiatives and performance within various universities. And it's actually super interesting to see how different universities react to the climate crisis and what they offer, what they're doing, what students are doing. And it ties in various benchmarks. Yeah, so going off of that to modern day climate solutions, how can education help combat, we talked about this earlier, but how can it help combat climate doom and climate anxiety?
Yeah, we talked about this earlier, but I really feel like it really comes down to how the education and solutions are presented. So I think role models would again be climate science, again, climatescience.org/courses or whatnot for the online courses on various matters of the issues such as industrial innovation, etc. I think the book Speed and Scale, but published just last year by John Doerr, would be another role model, because it presented in a way, is the book's content about the solution to climate change are presented in a way that don't invoke climate doomism at all, and it focuses enough on it covers enough of the state of the issue for you to know that to you to have a solid foundation of the problem itself, because what's the saying again, it's like you can't form a proper solution unless you first like properly understand the issue itself. So I think also of the role models for how solutions can be presented without bringing up climate anxiety or even combating climate anxiety, I think interactive components are a huge plus. And that's not even limited to project-based learning in schools or college courses or whatnot. It could also be using climate simulators and incorporating those into, if it's schooling, then coursework or projects, or I know that even in Speed and Scale there was this resource that I personally like to use a lot called the Energy Policy Simulator, which is a peer-reviewed, regularly updated simulator that covers, I think, enough regions to cover over half of the world's emissions, such as the US, China, parts of Europe, etc. And I think giving people the option, showing people the option that visually in real time, like what certain themes of related to the climate centers that we mentioned today, such as policy prioritization, some solutions are way better than others, themes of what separates effective policies from optional policies, etc. Those themes can be very well taught and shown and represented in simulators and other interactive tools in a way that just reading about it on books or learning about it through a lecture can't. And I think, and perhaps most importantly of all, young people, it really needs to be emphasized to young people that they can and should actively seek to be part of the broader systemic solution, because what they do with education matters, no matter what extent they got it from school or their own means, and they're not alone in this fight. I think the Youth for Climate Manifesto section on education is very well worth checking out on the subject, and that's available through a simple Google search, just Youth for Climate Manifesto, and it's a UN like FCCC document, and yeah.
So with this, is climate education a sustainable goal that can be reached by various communities and in low-income countries all over the world? Like, is this globally possible?
It'll be challenging, of course, like any climate sub-issue, but there are definitely a few places to start. I think mandating climate education in schools is a lot better than just incentivizing, you know, again, mandatory versus optional. But unlike, you know, mainstream climate mitigation issues, like how do you clean up the power grid, for example, I feel like with regards to climate education, people who design the policy solution to these issues or other solutions must really first identify the root cause of the problem, like I said, and then remove those barriers. And also needs to be a priority for government worth spending political capital on. And they need to be shown that's a priority through both outside movement pressure and also support from current politicians in office that this matters and is worth proposing legislation on, even if it's never done before. I'm not completely positive, like, when's the last time something similar to the Youth Climate Bill has been proposed, like, at a federal level, but it's probably safe to say it's been a while since there's been any proposed legislation in Congress at the U.S. level, in the U.S., that would seek to look out for the younger generation on such an important issue like climate change. I think, independent of school, initiatives like what Climate Science is doing and what we at the Climate Unity will be doing with the Saga Park rollout have enormous potential in that they don't need school or government's approval to be widely used by youth, and they can even be later incorporated into school curriculums. I think Climate Science already has that to some extent. And the other component of this topic is that climate solutions and policy info must also be accessible in languages other than English to be able to expand everywhere at scale, especially the low-income countries where the first language is not English. And that is fortunately something that a nonprofit founded a couple years ago called Climate Cardinals, space here in the US, is actually working to change. I hope you've heard of that. And from a personal standpoint, I'm hoping soon that they will be happy to take on translating some of our climate communities, like stockpile resources as well, to whatever extent they're able to. And then, so it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward on this, and both outside of and within what I have planned for the Youth Climate Bill campaign for climate ingenuity, and because it is very important and a time-sensitive issue that unfortunately doesn't get enough attention. And it is something that, like I emphasized earlier, is something that we really, as a society, don't want to be too late on in terms of addressing and whatnot.
Yeah, overall, education as a whole can encourage people to change their attitudes and behavior and make informed decisions. So specifically, young people can be taught the impact of global warming, learn how to adapt, learn how to learn solutions and learn how to create policy to adapt to climate change and deal with it overall. And we are coming to the end of this interview, and I've had two guest interviews so far. I've asked both of them this question. I've gotten a lot of responses, a wide variety. So what are three movies or books that you would recommend to my audience about climate education and policy-based solutions, and why?
Well, the first one I already mentioned, Speed and Scale by John Dewar, published just last October. Again, I feel like you probably have a very like strong unapologetic recency bias when it comes to climate resources. I think there's something great in it for everyone. The case studies are wonderful. The author John interviews a lot of, I think like over 30 different like people, both in the government, nonprofits, civil society, all over, people working, actively working through their careers to address this problem. And in terms of policy or solutions, it's just, I feel like it's just the right amount compared to the other policy books I've read in that. It's enough for you to, for a person with no background in policy to follow and follow well, but it's not so much, I guess, too overly technical and you in a sense that one would have to have prior background in policy to be able to understand. I think the other book, it's not exactly with the climate education, but it's I would say the second book would be, it's called The Obstacles Away by Ryan Holiday. There's a quote from, there's a testimonial on the back, but I think it says something along the lines of, a book for the bedside of every future and current leader in the world. So if that doesn't draw on anyone, a young person who wants to make a substantial difference on the issue of climate change, then I really don't know what will. and I think it really, I've read it quite a while back, but it still, even to this day, reinforces an essential critical thinking skills for anyone, like I said, who wants to, like sort of like I did, find their own voice and style in terms of change making in this space. And then I think, in terms of climate specifically, I think the documentary Before the Flood from 2016 by Leonardo DiCaprio would be a good source of inspiration on, you know, the urgency of the issue and some of the solutions to it, from someone who has a boom, very, at least in my opinion, very strong proven track record of doing the right thing on these issues in Leo. And then, but if you're looking for a movie that has overlapping themes of climate, but isn't exactly about climate, of course, then I'll go with The Martian, actually, because the overlapping themes include, but not limited to, you know, the ingenuity, to find creative solutions to these problems, collaboration among those in power and those not, and I think also humor as a source of strength, because that's the other aspect of actively working in the space, is that being able to set boundaries, healthy boundaries for yourself, and proper self-care, and it's like resilience as like fighting back against the status quo, something like that, that matters. And like, we all need that to maximize our impact on stopping climate change in whatever form that takes, and whatever level that is. So
yeah, no, the use of humor as a weapon, actually, in school we learned about Voltaire, right? The philosopher from the 17th, 16th century, I think the use of humor as being used as a weapon against anxiety against doom, against sort of climate existentialism, like nihilism, like, well, it's already here, it's already over, so what can we do, right? And this sort of how it's sort of essential to keep modern society going. I enjoyed this conversation a lot. And finally, before we go, are there any last statements you would like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I think the number one piece of advice I would give is one I'll give my former self too, if I was able to talk to myself from my past self from, 2 years ago when I didn't have any of these initiatives of Atlanta Profit or whatnot, is get involved and over time find your unique voice and change making style. And there's climate allies and helpers everywhere, and it's just a matter of for everyone. It's just a matter of you needing to find and connect with them and build that relationship. I think regarding the climate policy, with the stockpile, just like speed and scale, I think is something in it for everyone. It's still under construction, but I'm working on some features such as making an ultra learning guide for it based on a book by the same name that's tailored for climate policy or solutions to how to learn the content much better and faster. Once I have come full circle, I'm bringing a content director for CI. I'm thinking of working with that person to design social media posts on climate policy principles, which would be helpful for, I think, for all audiences. So if you're interested in staying in the loop or updated on what my nonprofit startup, or hopefully it won't be a startup anymore much longer, if you're interested in continuing to follow what Climate Ingenuity will be up to moving forward regarding the stockpile rollout or these climate bill or any of that, you can follow it on Instagram. It's just Climate Ingenuity, the two words. And then I mentioned climate science multiple times here in this episode. I think I mentioned earlier that they're doing the Olympiad again this year, right? So that's a fantastic way to apply solutions, policy or otherwise, about climate in a way that's fun, doesn't bring forth climate anxiety, and it's a unique opportunity that I really hope that they'll keep offering from year in and year out moving forward. So if you're interested in that, taking part in that, you can go to climatescience.org/Olympiad. And it's a lot of fun, but I can't guarantee anyone will win, because they're trying to, from what I heard, they're trying to have a million participants this year. So compared to 10,000 or 12,000 last year. So yeah, I think it was great chatting with you too, and I hope this conversation was insightful and for your audience.
Yeah, it certainly was. So that's all for this episode. Thank you for talking to me, Rupeng. This was super interesting. It was a very relevant topic to discuss too in this day and age. Thanks to my audience for listening. I hope you guys all enjoyed it. Be sure to follow this podcast on Instagram at icebreaker.podcast and check out icebreakerpodcast.card.co. Thanks for listening. Bye.
That's all we have for this episode. Thank you for listening to part 2. Check out part 1 if you haven't. I hope you enjoyed it. I will be tagging Climate Ingenuity and Rupeng's handle at icebreaker.podcast. And I hope you have a great rest of your day. Bye!